This morning I'd like to share opening words from the poet Robert Hayden. This poem comes from a collection of poems of which I am one of the people who has a poem in this anthology, so his is a much better poem than mine, so I'll read his. Those winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, he made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake up and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call. And slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of this house. Speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my shoes as well, what did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? Of what did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? Good morning. From the cares that fret, the burdens that weary, from work that is just too hard, the voices that distract us, I invite you into the sanctuary of stillness, of renewal. Here we invite the commotion of the outer world, your outer world, everything that's out there to settle, to still, so that you may hear that inner voice that reasons with a fine balance and lifts up the needs of the heart. And to remember to be truly grateful. Grateful for the hard work of others that bring us our food, clothes, electricity, gas, housing, cars, books, movies, the progressive voices of our Unitarian Universalist faith that inspire us to grow from all that we have been given and all that we give back. So please, on this celebration of all the things that we do to make this world a better place and to just keep on going, greet your neighbor. Greet that person next to you, behind you, around you. I'd like to point out our announcements in the order of service. Please pay attention to those because they give order to our weeks and months. So the announcements are there. And now look for the blue or the teal hymnal, as it is called, which you should find one in, underneath a chair somewhere. It's this book, Singing the Journey, and we're going to sing 1017, Building a New Way. And stand when you find your place, and we will learn this new song. Let's start over one more time. Let's start all together. So, okay, one, two, three, let's go.
We are building a new way. We are building
working, is it? This is a beautiful song. Is Pat Embers here? I thought you were going to help us lead this, Pat, so come up. Yes, you had said that. All right, now we're going to do this. Go get it right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Do we have this mic on over here? All right. All right. We'll try one more time, and if we can't get it, we'll do it again some other time. All right, let's go. Much for taking the risk of learning this song, even though we have a long way to go, it sounds. But to stay alive and to stay vibrant, we need to take risks. So in that spirit, we did a great job. Now is the time in our order of service when we set aside a place where we can recognize and hear with open hearts those sorrows and joys that illuminate and cast shadow in our lives. If you have a personal joy or concern or a mix, would you please share it now?
Thanks. I'm Kristen Corwin with A Simple Joy. Logan Washburn turned 2 last week, and we're very proud of him.
Yay! Good job.
Hi, I'm Charlie Kempthorne, and this is my new granddaughter. I declare Kempthorne. Her name is Ada Claire Kempthorne, and I'm going to quickly narrate this. It was on the night of August 22nd. I was down in Oregon on the South Coast doing workshops, and June was with the mama. Some of you may remember Rip, our son. It's his wife in Tacoma, and June attended the birth, and it was sort of like, this is kind of a strange comparison, but if you've ever seen that film clip, video clip of the wreck of the Hindenburg, that exploded, you know, and the announcer's very calm and deliberate, and suddenly this horrible explosion occurs as it's landing, and he gets terribly excited. Well, reverse that awful the horror of it completely and into joy, and here's June playing the announcer on the cell phone while I'm down in Oregon, and, oh, she's being born, oh, she has hair all over her. So it was just a most wonderful moment of our lives together, so thanks for listening. Okay.
Thank you.
I have a joy that I got that I get to visit a cat, and we have a cat visiting us.
Stephen Mall here. I have a joy that our good friends Jim and Barbara Bascom are visiting from Washington. Seems like
right.
They've been gone
hey.
For, gosh, almost a month. And my mom and I have sold our house, so we're in our last month here. We'll be out pulling out September 28th, so got to get a lot of friendship time in. So.
Well, we'd like to thank Steve, but let me tell you, a cheap house is a good house. And also, I didn't want to. I know our, you know, politics now is all based on money and such. And I just, Anyway, some time ago, I bought a truck, and I've got it for sale, and it's called Sheba, and works very well, except in hot weather, which, let me tell you, you got more than your share of. And so anybody that wants it, with exception of military and such, of course.
This sounds like a sorrow.
Marilyn Caldwell, I hate to say this, but the circle dinner was supposed to be at my house, and since I'm going to be packing, that might not be a good idea for this coming Friday, so we're looking for an alternate place. And there's 11 people signed up. If we had it at a bigger house, we could have more people. But I just want to chat with people afterwards to see if we can relocate, because I'm going to be pulling all the books out of my bookcase. That's where my dining room table is. So.
I have both a joy and a concern. I want to thank whoever put Kiwi out for the refreshments last week, because I decided to trial my son's food allergies, and he had been allergic to Kiwi and has outgrown it, so that was very exciting. But a concern that my daughter has now failed fully a third of the foods that we have tried with her on food allergies, so we're struggling with that.
It seems now appropriate time to light the chalice to be reminded of what the Gospel of Matthew says. You are the light of the world. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel basket, but on a lampstand, and gives it life to the whole house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good works. So let us let our light shine. Now, Kim, I believe it's yes. All right.
Children, children, come talk to me. Hi, Chalicey. How's it going? So
today we're going to be talking about, like, work. Boring, right? But, you know, you guys don't really do lots of work. You play right now, right? But when you get bigger like me and like all these grown-ups, you guys might have some jobs, right? Maybe. Make some money. Does anybody have any? I know we've talked about this before, but I can't remember. Does anybody know, like, something maybe they want to do when they grow up? Maybe? Chelsea?
I want to be an oceanographer.
That's awesome. Connor?
Worldwide veterinarist.
Whoa. That's really cool. Jake?
When I get bigger, I want to have a drum set and a yo-yo.
That is excellent. Kaya?
I want to be a hotel monitor.
Any other ideas? Do you know? What do you want to be when you grow up?
Paedologist.
A paleontologist. That's fancy. Yes.
I'm a garbage man.
Garbage man? Sweet. That would be really fun. Well, we saw this movie one time. It was called City of Ember. Has anybody here seen that? Do you remember assignment day? Yeah? Well, we're going to have assignment day right here. This is like kind of a pretend thing, right? But we are going to have what's called assignment day, where you guys don't need to think about what you want to be when you grow up, because we're just going to tell you what you're going to be, okay? So everybody line up. Everybody line up. How about across the stage right here? Don't trip on the cords. Does everybody want to line up? Because everybody wants to see you. This is very official. We're going to tell you right now what you're going to be when you grow up. Okay, so don't look. Take one. Don't look at it. You can look at it after you get it, but don't look when you're getting one. Go ahead and grab one. Okay. Which one do you want?
There you go.
Here. Indigo, go ahead and grab one. Everybody take one. Where's Connor? Connor, you already got one, right? You got to come over here. So we're going to find out. This is what they're going to be when they grow up. They don't need to think about it, right? We're just going to tell you what you're going to be. Connor, do you want to come stand over here? I want to find out what you're going to be. Connor, what are you going to be when you grow up?
It says construction worker.
Awesome. He's going to be a construction worker. I think you'll be good at that. Ellie, do you have one? What does Ellie say?
A news reporter.
A news reporter. You'll probably be good at that. Do you know what yours says? Can I look at it? Okay, Carter. Carter is going to be a toilet scrubber. You get to clean toilets. Yay. That's really cool. Burke. What does yours say?
Do you scientist.
Know? Scientist. Burke's going to be a scientist. What does yours say?
Zookeeper. Zookeeper.
A zookeeper. Well, that's pretty good. Charles, do you know what yours says?
A nurse.
A nurse. Nick, what are you going to be?
A professor.
Professor. That's appropriate. Wait. Kai, do you know what yours says?
Yeah, I do.
Inventor.
Kai is going to be an inventor.
What does this one say?
Oh, you're. Jake is going to be a wasp exterminator. So you're gonna be the guy that gets wasps out of people's houses. Does that sound cool?
But I really wanted to be an astronaut.
Oh, I'm sorry. Not today. Indigo, what are you? Oh.
I'm an RE teacher.
That's perfect. Did we get everybody? No? Oh, what's Logan going to be?
Logan is going to be a minister.
It really does say that. So, did everybody go? Jocelyn. Why does yours say Jocelyn? Can I see? Jocelyn, you're going to be a florist. You're going to work with flowers. Does that sound good? So, what do you guys think? Now you know what you're going to be. Is everybody happy?
No?
Burke is definitely happy.
What did Burke get?
He got a scientist. Indigo, why aren't you happy?
Because I don't really want to be an RE teacher.
What would you rather be?
Artist.
An artist? Yeah. Is that maybe where your talents lie, perhaps? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is anybody else unhappy about their choice? Nick? Why?
Just cuz.
Just cuz. Could you rather be something else?
Yes.
We traded.
What?
So you'd rather be something else?
I'd rather be something else.
So luckily, you guys don't really have to be these things when you grow up, right? Luckily, we get to kind of choose what we want to do and maybe choose our talents. So I hope that you can really follow your talents and follow what you really want to do when you grow up instead of being these things that I pretended to tell you you have to be someday. Would that make you happier? Maybe. Nick says he would be a good professor, but he's just choosing not to be that. So that's okay. I understand. All right. No, we're not going to read the ones that are left, unless anybody else in here wants to know what they want to be when they grow up. All right, thank you, kids. We're all going to exit out the back.
May the work of our hands, minds, and hearts benefit others. May we express our appreciation for all that has been given to us, all that we have worked for, by giving generously so that we may share the gift of our progressive and inclusive values. Let us receive the offering.
None of those children wanted to be an nutter upper, which I have a hard time understanding. I used to be a nutter-upper for about 7 months. What you do is you put nuts on bolts. The nuts come through this big hopper. The bolts are right next to you in another big hopper. And a little thing called the whirly bird whirls those nuts around. You go, whoosh, whoosh, boom, put them in the box. Only 50 can go in a box. No more will fit. And if you start them wrong and start throwing them in there crossways, you have to take them all out again. So it's quite a job. I mean, I actually kind of got to like it. I ended up being pretty good at it, as a matter of fact. After 7 months, I was the second highest, fastest nutter-upper at McGraw-Edison Corporation. And it was kind of a lot of fun, but I could never get to number one. There was a man there, I don't know how long he'd been doing this, but he could fly. It was like poetry in motion. And every so often you'd get a burr on one of those nuts, and it would take my wrist and go like that, instead of me turning around, instead of the nut turning around, it was my hand turning around. People had actually broken their hands that way. Never happened with that guy. He was great. So that was my basic, I couldn't get any better than that. I didn't think, I couldn't really, I was a Salieri, he was a Mozart. You know, it wasn't gonna work. I kept trying and trying, and finally they moved me to another job, which was putting molten zinc on bolts and nuts and all kinds of metallic things. It required some real heft, and you can tell, still don't have a lot of real heft. I had to dig this big thing through these bolts and put them in this big shovel and put them in this hot basket. Don't touch it. You got two sets of gloves on, but if you touch that basket, you're going to get burned immediately. The smell of burning hair was always around in this place. It was amazing. 1 week, I said, I'd rather be a nutter-upper. That's my job. I'm tired of getting my hair burned. And I can't get through those. My fingernails started to come off. They told me, don't worry. This guy said, don't worry. He's about 200 pounds, about my size. And he said, I was your size when I started. You'll be okay. I thought, well, maybe that's not what I want to do. I thought about it. I said, I can do this pretty well, but maybe something else in life is calling me. I'd been out of school for about 6 months, got through 2 years of college and with mediocre results. And so I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And one day, I decided I had to try something else. And I didn't know what else to try, but I thought, I'll just go out to the University of Kansas, which is where it's the only one I knew about then. I said, I'll go out there because I can fly there for free because my father works for the TWA. And off I went and started studying. But it was really funny how that job was a thing that I actually was good at. I wonder if I would still be doing it today if I was had found friends there and things like that. I might be Mozart now. I don't know. Maybe not. I just trusted that I'd know it when I saw it. I'd know something was worthwhile when I finally saw it. And there had to be something that gave me more back than being a nutter upper, which was a good, strong career, but not the one I chose. That's all I have to say.
Thoreau always comes to mind when I think of work because he thought deep and hard about it and wrote a lot about it, actually. But here is a quote that I'd like to share with you called, "To Live Deliberately." We should live, why should we live in such a hurry and waste of life? We are determined to be starved before we are hungry. I wish to live deliberately. To front only the essential facts of life. I wish to learn what life has to teach, and not, when I come to die, discover that I have not lived. I do not wish to live what is not life. Living, living is so dear. Nor do I wish to practice resignation unless it is absolutely necessary. I wish to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life. I want to cut a broad swath to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. If it proves to be mean, then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world. Or if it is sublime, to know it by experience, and to be able to give a true account of it. Making light. What do you do with your days? What do you consider your work? Do you like what you do? Do you love what you do? What do you get out of it? What do you give to it? Are you serving a higher purpose? If you are, does it bring you a sense of wholeness and bursts of joy? Work, physical or mental effort or activity directed toward the accomplishment of something. Toil, labor, that's what the dictionary says. Labor comes from the Latin drudgery, hardship, to suffer. When you think about work, how it works in our culture and across the world, our times, it is a complex convergence of all kinds of things. It's impossible to get a full and complete picture of it. But think about it. Children, child labor. If you eat Hershey bars, know that there are children who are picking those cocoa beans in suffering conditions. Women all over the world are still trying to find a decent wage so that they can support their families, not only in Africa, but in America and in Manhattan. There's still forced prostitution in this country, where young women are brought in and forced to be prostitutes. There's the question of wage parity, discrimination because of your sexual identity, gender identification. The work conditions for all people could be better. When I was in New York and I could see all those skyscrapers, I said, where is the window you can open? Where is the fresh air? Where is the breeze that lifts up the morning light that comes in through into you in that place that's crammed with people? A place that many people think of as paradise. And here in Manhattan, they defeated the Human Rights Ordinance, which gave LGBT people, Q people, the right to not fear being discriminated against in housing or labor. And it was just cut off as if it meant nothing. It does mean something. Believe me, it means a lot. Because if one person doesn't have the right, then everybody suffers. It can't be lopsided. It can't be weighted towards one group of people or two groups of people or three groups of people. If one group is suffering, everybody on some level suffers. So, but for someone without food or shelter, the ability to earn a wage which provides the necessities of housing, of food, of medical attention when you need it, are basic things that people work for. But once they have enough money to pay for that, they sometimes yearn for more, as Charles did when he was trying to decide what to do in between that 2 years of college and the next, what was it, 7 years of college? You know, that time when you just have to pay for the rent and pay for the food and build up enough money so that you can go to school. That is a real privilege that we have in America, that we can actually build up enough money so that we can go to school, better ourselves, find a job that we love, or at least hope that we love. When do the highest aspirations that you hold in your heart and mind come out in your everyday work? Do you think about it? Even if you're retired, even if you're one of those people that has lots of leisure time, what do you call your work? And when you figure that out, do you ever ask, am I living out my values, the values that are most dear to me, that I would give my life for? I can remember that one of the best jobs I ever had was probably one of the most drudgery-filled jobs ever. It was called Love at First Bite. I was a quiche maker, and I made gourmet pâtés. Have you ever broken a gross of eggs in a big container? That's 144 eggs. And then you have to turn the beater on, and then you have to make 25 quiches, and then you have to make pâtés. It's just work. It's repetitive. But I worked with someone who was the absolute funniest, loveliest person that I ever worked with. She was just charming. And we just laughed, and we talked about things. We talked about the problems we were having in our relationships and the good things and the bad things. But it was always, always a joy to work with her. It was easy. The job itself, you know, it was fun, but come on, how many quiches can you make? 10,000? Well, I didn't want to make 10,000, but I made 9. Hard work was absolutely the highest value in my family. It is the value that held most dear. Laziness was scorned. If you were lazy, that meant you were not a good person. Reading a book before you had all your homework done or had done your chores, whoa, bad, bad, lazy, lazy, lazy. Working in my family, physical work, to be a good worker, wow, that was the highest ambition, and my sisters did a really good job of it, and I kind of flunked out. And they earned that from their parents. My grandmother, Olga, my mother's mother, she came from a family in Sweden where the father was off in America and the mother raised 5 children on her own and built a barn and hoed the fields and planted the potatoes and wove fancy tablecloths for the rich. So they knew that every second that they had, they needed to either be working or cleaning or doing something to lift up the family. So these things come naturally down the pike, so to speak, come down as values that we inherit. And each of my grandparents and great-grandparents came from incredibly not difficult circumstances, but they all came to America because they did not want to be stuck in that life of subsistence living. They wanted the right to lift themselves up and have leisure time, to take a vacation. My great-grandparents never took a vacation. That was unheard of in my family, unless it was for a funeral or a wedding. But the concept of doing something just for yourself was foreign. I had to help as long as I can remember. My first memories are of dragging the dishes to the sink and then having to wash them or dry them and then to clean my bedroom, and then we had to sweep the gangway, and then there was all the mowing and the shoveling. It was endless. My mother always thought you should have a job. And so at 10, I had my first paying job, which was delivering newspapers. I hated it. But I did it until I got fired. Oh, I don't know why that happened, but it did. And then I have had so many jobs that it's hard to count. But at 14, I was hired to work for a veterinarian, and I cleaned out the cages of sick animals and well animals, and I also got to help with surgery. Can you imagine a 14-year-old boy holding this clamp, holding that? It was fascinating. That was a great job. It was interesting. But then I got tired of having to go put the noose on the dog that had bit somebody at the airport, because we were close to O'Hara Airport. And if you have a German Shepherd, they're just going, ah, at you. And you're told, go in there and put a noose around him so that you can put him in a cage. Right. Well, I learned to do it, but I never got over my fear. So I thought, this is not a job for me. And then I went on and did all kinds of things. I mean, I worked at drugstores, and I worked at libraries. I worked at feeding the animals for the psychology department in college. And, of course, I was too tender-hearted to let the rat starve, so my friends couldn't understand why their experiments weren't working out. You know, I just couldn't help it, though. That poor rat was shriveling up. So I would feed it, and I admitted later to my friends that I'd done it. So that wasn't a good job for me either, because I couldn't follow the rules. And one of the jobs that I thought would be the greatest job ever was to own a bookstore. Wow, a bookstore. I mean, this is heaven to me. As a child, going to the library or a bookstore was such a great adventure. So Chuck and I and my sister decided we would open up a bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas, which would show the world that you could have multicultural exchange that was meaningful, had depth, and really brought community together. The bookstore did that, but it was a charity. We had to work day and night, and it drained us of everything in the end. So what had started out as this great idealistic dream ended up almost burying us. So it's interesting to see how when you reach for your dreams, sometimes that dream is not what you need. Or it turns out to have another side that you had no way of anticipating. I thought through hard work, creativity, we would make it. And to this day, we still meet people who say, wow, that was one of the greatest bookstores I've ever been in. So yes, we do receive the reward of having done that great work, but God, it was tough. So as one looks at their life and you look at all the jobs, between all of us, I'm sure we range the whole gamut. What jobs have you had that really surprised you with how much fun they were? With those moments when you met someone in the eye and you could really feel that person and everything they were going through. That sense of being in community where you were together working for a common cause. In our Unitarian Universalist history, I'd like to just take a moment to look at the Reverend Arthur Buckminster Fuller. Yes, he is related to Buckminster Fuller. He was Margaret Fuller, who is more well-known, or is more well-known's brother. She was a transcendentalist, the first woman who edited a major magazine in the United States, The Dial, a transcendentalist magazine. But her younger brother endeavored to give the Unitarian Church appeal to all social classes and championed the important liberal reforms of the day. When Fuller was 13, his father died. Arthur worked for the family farm. Margaret helped raise him and ensured that he received a proper education and preparation for college. With limited financial resources, Arthur devoted some of his time while at Harvard Divinity School to teaching in local schools to support himself. Before he attended Divinity School, he became a lay missionary, preaching over a wide area in Illinois. After his ordination, he served the New North Church in Boston. The New North Church was situated in a changing neighborhood, as many of the cities on the seaboard were always having this great influx of immigrants. And in Boston at that time, when he was a minister, there was a great influx of Italians who brought their Catholicism with them. He shunned denominationalism. Got that? Fuller was a force behind the church so that they would not have a sectarian name. He emphasized the growth of the Sabbath school, which took in destitute children. Children who had no opportunity to learn how to read or write, who often did not have enough food. Fuller was a friend of the poor and the outcast. He believed that workers and farmers and other common folk would flock to Unitarianism if they received God's message of universal love, a love that did not distinguish between how poor you were or how rich you were, where you went to school, who your parents were, who your grandparents were. And New England in the 19th century, it was incredibly stratified. And Unitarianism was really stratified. It was for the elite. So there were forces at work at the height of that to begin to bring in a more gracious, generous ability to integrate everybody, as they believed God's message to be. Fuller was an advocate of many of the reforms of his day, including abolition and public education. And another person, another reverend who did a lot and who is believed to be the father of social work is the Reverend Joseph Tuckerman. His ministry to the poor began as the ministry at large in 1826 and continues to this day as a Unitarian Universalist urban ministry. Tuckerman believed that having to pay, now just imagine if you had to pay for the seat that you sat in, how many of you would stay home? It was common. It was absolutely the way things worked, that you paid for your pew seat. So if you didn't have the money, you did not have the right to go to a Unitarian church. He really worked to shift that so that there would be Unitarian churches where people did not pay for their pews, that they were welcome, regardless of how much money they had, what educational level they had. It was more important, what did they bring in their heart? What did they bring in their heart to help move the community into its wholeness? His mission, he said, was to elevate the masses, to enable every individual to surmount every obstacle in the way to the highest moral completeness within their attainment. The highest moral completeness. which means in our language today, at least for me, how do you integrate all the pieces of your life, all those things that you do in a day into a whole, so that there are moments when everything comes together. And when you feel the goodness of your being as a whole person, he was asking for this in 19th century Boston. He did a lot of good work in the Ministry for the Urban Affairs across the country. It does important work. Recently, if any of you read in the Sierra Club magazine, there is an article about the Barefoot College. I just love this. And in the Barefoot College, women come to India's Barefoot College from villages in Fiji, Peru, Rwanda, Liberia. They come unschooled, and at 6 months, they leave as solar engineers, ready to bring more light to the world. In 2004, the Barefoot College in Tilonia, India, trained 250 illiterate, semi-illiterate women in rural villages without electricity from 41 countries, providing almost 16,000 houses with solar electricity. India's government pays about $4,400 per woman. And the current class, 34 women come from 8 countries. Together, they have 137 children. 7 of them can't sign their name or read a word. Sanjit Bunker Roy, the founder of the Barefoot College, came from one of those extremely privileged backgrounds. He went to the top schools. He got the top honors. He was prepared to launch into the Indian highest levels of work. But between places like Chuck, he stopped, and he went to the desert in India. And it was in 1967, and there was a great drought, and the famine was extensive. People were dying everywhere. He said, "I felt like I needed to do something." So he got a job digging wells. He jokes, his mother went into a coma. How could my son, who is so well prepared to lead this country, dig a well? But then he realized as he dug those wells and brought water, the people that needed it to survive, not just to wash their clothes, but to make it from day to day, he thought, what would happen if we provided some kind of way for these people to lift up their ability to take care of themselves? And thus he started the Barefoot College in 1972. He wanted them to know practical stuff that could improve their lives and improve the lives of their children so that they could build simple, sustainable communities. 33% of the people in India live below the international poverty level. Does anyone know how much that is per day? What is the international poverty level? $1.25. 33% of India's population lives below that level. Sanjit opened the Barefoot College in 1972. The campus houses a medical clinic, a pathology lab, a library, a media room, a dining hall, a dairy shop, accounting offices, and dormitories whose roofs collect 100,000 gallons of water a year and generate 50 kilowatts of solar energy. During the 9 sunny months, they cook on parabolic cookers made by female welders on campus. He found that training men, while a good thing, was also not helping to build simple, sustainable communities because many of them went off to larger places and got better jobs. They wanted to leave. And he found that the women were often the people who valued the relationship to their history in that village and all the people that lived there. So he found that trying to offer education to them actually helped to build the sustainable, simple communities he believed in. This college so far has trained 150,000 women, most of them untrained before coming to this college. Today they are teachers, construction workers, water testers, artisans, photographers, dentists, social activists, and solar engineers. These women have brought basic service, water, light, education, and healthcare to at least 500,000 people. That is great work. For Sanjit, it is about doing something for your village no one else was willing to do. So what is it that you are willing to do for your community, for your people, for your family, that no one else is willing to do, and to take it on so that you can build sustainable families, sustainable communities that care and bring the opportunity for education and for good health and for good lives to everyone? Helping the poor, inventing something that will help lead better lives, having a greater love in your life. I have thought about this, and believe me, I'm all over the map, as you can tell, because it's just such a complex issue. You know, you think that if you get this, you will be happy. So for some of us, it starts, oh, I want the love of my life. You get the love of your life, and well, you keep on going. What's next? Oh, if I only had, you know, this. You get that. It's nice. It's good. You're happy for whatever, a month, a year. And you get a better job that you love. You're happy. It fulfills you. But there are times of despair. There are times when things feel broken, when things don't work, when the communication lines are shut down. And all those circles, all those currents of communication and energy flow. When things just don't work. What happens if your partner is killed, or a child of yours is killed, or they have an illness that forever makes them unable to do what they had dreamed that they wanted to do? What do you do? What do you do when you can no longer do what gave meaning and identity to your life? What then do you stand on to lift up the goodness? What do you have? What do you have beyond your identity? Where in your life do you draw upon when everything else fails? This is where we turn to the art of living. It's the greatest job. And to thine own self be true, to really understand who you are and what your gifts are in spite of what you are able to do physically or mentally, is often right here. If you have a stroke and can no longer use that part of your brain, does that mean your life is meaningless? No. If part of your brain was destroyed that allowed you to be a high-functioning lawyer, does that mean your life is worthless? No. Does it mean that you have to go through a period of disintegration in the dark night of the soul to rediscover who you are so that you can lift yourself up and so that you can contribute to the common good in the smallest or the largest way that you can? Yes, that's what it means. That's the work. That's the real work. You may think of yourselves as this or that, but in the end, that probably won't make much difference. So when you come to die, when you reach that moment when you're dying, you know with every fiber of your being that you have done your best to live out your values. And no matter what job you have, it's the values that underlie that that give real meaning and real support to a good life. And it often has to do with the heart. How open is your heart to whatever comes, to dealing with it and finding meaning and moving on and sharing? Hard work, good work, filled with lots of fun, but it's also sometimes dark. But our job is to make light, like those women at the Barefoot College who build those solar lights and bring lights to their village and electricity. It's our job to do the same in our own lives and for those that we love and for those that we don't even know. It's all the same. It's good work. So, I know I've kind of done this, gone on all these places. Where in the journey this morning do you find a place that resonates with you so that you know who you are as a human being and as a worker? Or what job has illuminated something for you that you were totally surprised by? What work do you love? What work provides those values that you hold dear to live fully? Elka.
Thinking.
Thinking.
Les Frazier, I liked your example of Barefoot College. It shows how he helped others, and I bet he was happy. And you talked about happiness. I'm reminded of Charles Colson, Watergate fame, who went to prison. And he had that dark nightness of the soul you speak about, and he turned his life around, and he started helping others. He knew executives of business on the beaches of Florida who owned mansions, and they had large second homes if they wanted to buy them. They played golf every day, he said. They weren't happy. Right. So his philosophy is helping others makes you happy. What do you think?
I would agree. Thank you, Les. Elka?
I wanted to go back to the first job issue. My very first job was to be a custodian helper at the age of 14 at the school where I attended. We, a few girls, just did that to earn a few marks. And I think it was the hardest job I ever did. We fell asleep during every break that we had in the morning, lunch, and in the afternoon. And I think I realized that this is a very hard life that I don't want to live. And I still feel with our custodials, custodian employees at USD 383 who have to work so hard. And my second job, I may have been 16 or 17 during spring break or summer break, I don't recall, was working in a factory, sitting on a machine, at a machine where you had to work with bolts and they just had to go through the machine. And I think I was never so bored in my entire life. So these were very, very good learning experiences for me at a very young age.
Thank you, Elka.
I had a kind of a period of time between playing at certain concert halls before I was 18 to 5 years later walking into a public school to teach a 20-minute lesson to a sixth grader who had never played before. And the type of feeling I have now, finally, years later, after all types of jobs, and coming to find that I love working with kids in another capacity, and I do enjoy getting to play for them when I when I do that. But most of my jobs the last 8 years have had nothing to do with the violin. But now, because of all those experiences in between, I feel that sitting and playing drones along with an offertory is as important as the notes I used to play in a New York concert hall, and I appreciate having that here.
Other possibilities, Marilyn, yes.
I think probably the most rewarding work that I've done has been for free. And it was running the Mystery Conclave, running a convention for people. It was a business meeting. It was trying to bring people to a place where they could network with each other and possibly have jobs. I love to write. I love to write stories. I like to get published again. Everybody who came to that convention felt the same way. And I felt like I was in some way helping them, giving back to the writers that I adored. We had so many good writers there. And that was the most rewarding. Unfortunately, it didn't pay anything. But it was very, very hard work and very, very rewarding. If my rewards come in whatever heaven there is, that will be it. A writer's heaven.
Someone else?
My most rewarding job was also a volunteer opportunity. When I was in my early 20s and I started working for a big construction company, I was also volunteering for Habitat for Humanity on the side. And I'd done that in college, and I really loved it. But when the organization found out that I was working for a construction company, they latched onto that and said, oh, you're so qualified, you should be our lead site coordinator for this house that we're building. And I was 22, and I wasn't that qualified, but perhaps I was the most qualified at the time. And so I took on the job of building this house, and I was completely in charge of it. And I didn't have a whole lot of support, especially from my company. They thought that I was maybe taking advantage of them and working on their time and things like that. But once I got to know the family, I threw myself into it because, I mean, I was building a house for this woman and her family. And I'd spent all of my extra time doing it, and it became my world. And toward the end of the project, I'll never forget seeing her kneeling in front of a window and thanking God. And I knew I was doing the right thing.
Ann Cowan, this all gets me thinking about how we end up choosing what we choose, because as a child, there was never anything I wanted to be. I was not much of a thinker and had no self-esteem. As a junior in high school, we were told to write a paper on what we wanted to be when we got through school. And the three choices in those days for a woman were secretary, nurse, or teacher. That was it. I mean, in my school system, no one mentioned, and there was no counseling. My love was math, but you couldn't be a mathematician. So I went to the library and took out a book on careers. And I wanted just to pass this paper I had to write. So I wanted to do something other than teacher, secretary, or nurse. I thought I'd get someone's attention. So the book flopped open to physical therapy. And there was a picture of a little blonde girl with ringlets and a ruffled pinafore and braces on her legs. And I thought, well, that looks like a nice job. So I wrote this paper on physical therapy. I'd never heard of it before. But after I wrote it and turned it in and got a fairly good grade, everyone said, so you want to be a physical therapist? Well, I couldn't say no. So I became a physical therapist. And I really enjoyed it. I did a good job. But that was how the decision came about. My mother wanted me to be a doctor. My father wanted me to be a teacher. I didn't want to be either one. So that was life that day in the library when the book flopped open.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for sharing. Now let us sing our closing hymn as we come marching, marching 109. Stand and let us give good voice. The song goes on. Let me share these closing words. Will you seek afar off? Surely you come back at last in things best known to you, finding the best at least as good as the best. Happiness, knowledge, not in another place, but in this place, not for another hour, but in this hour. So, go in peace. Thank you.